From WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. The outgoing head of A.O. Smith talks about the constant reinvention of the longtime Milwaukee manufacturer. Then, as we get closer to April 15th, one financial educator says we should aim to keep what we owe or get refunded to around $500.
If I get that money, certainly I can come up with a variety of ways to spend it. But if I owe that money, the amount of time that I need to work that into my budget and repay it is relatively short, and it's short-term pain.
And self-described misfits made up Milwaukee's punk scene in the late 70s and early 80s.
People who didn't fit in school or weren't listening to what everybody else was listening to, and they went to Zach's, and they discovered themselves. They could do whatever they wanted.
Lake Effect comes your way next, after the news. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for tuning in today. A few weeks ago, we got some insight into the effort to establish Milwaukee's water economy from the author of a profile on Milwaukee Water Council co-founder Rich Musin. Musin leads the Milwaukee-based water meter manufacturer Badger Meter. The council's other co-founder leads a company that was not originally linked to the freshwater industry. But in the decade that Paul Jones has led the A.O. Smith Corporation, the Milwaukee-based manufacturer has emerged as a global leader in making hot water heaters. The company was once well known for making frames for most of the cars built in this country. The company also made bombs for the military in World Wars I and II, and until recently, small electric motors. And while the company no longer employs the more than 10,000 people it did in its Milwaukee heyday, it remains headquartered here with a substantial workforce. But it's seeing rapid growth in other parts of the world, such as China and India, and it's ramping up its operations in those places as a result. With the company's revenue now approaching $2 billion, Paul Jones will step down from the job of executive chairman in April, although he'll remain on the company's board of directors. Jones sat down recently with Lake Effect's Mitch Tyke in conversation at the University Club of Milwaukee, and he talked about whether in the globalized world it's still important to make things in the United States.
I think it's important that we make stuff anywhere, but manufacturing has been my career. It started when I was still in college, and I think it's just something that everybody can relate to. Everything you look at has been manufactured by somebody. And I think it's important that we manufacture. I happen to believe that America can be as competitive as anybody in the world.
And you happen to lead a company that makes stuff that it's advantageous to make it locally, or at least make it in the United States, because it doesn't ship well or it's difficult to ship long distances, right?
Right. It's very expensive. We make water heaters, so you've got a big steel can full of air that's very difficult to ship very far. We manufacture in several countries around the world, but always for local use. People, as I like to explain, people in China and India and Europe and other parts of Asia like warm showers as well as we do.
People who have lived in Milwaukee for a long time know A.O. Smith as being heavily involved in the automobile industry. Do you think A.O. Smith today is visible in the community? When you tell people that you lead A.O. Smith, are they aware of what you do today?
Well, I think a little more so. We do have a lot of community involvement, not only the boards I'm on, but several members of the senior staff are involved in the local community. So I think there's more awareness now that I haven't had anybody tell me in years that they thought we'd gone bankrupt because we got out of the automotive business in 1997. But you know, the reason being unibody construction eliminated the products that we were making. So I think more and more people know. We do have a foundation that contributes well over $1 million a year to local charities, and a lot of us sit on different boards. So I think there's a little bit more awareness of the community and what A.O. Smith can contribute.
You are in your last few months as executive chairman. How do you view where the company was 10 years ago when you joined it and where you see it today as you're getting ready to leave it, at least on a full-time basis?
Well, the company has always reinvented itself many, many times. The last 10 or 11 years has just been another on that journey as we moved the company towards more of a water-related business. We sold our electric motor business. We had previously sold the automotive business. We didn't shut that down. We sold it to another company. They shut it down. Fiberglass pipe, everybody knows the Harvest Store. We've had ATM machines. Lots of things we've done over the years where we can always, using innovation using technology, have reinvented ourselves. So this was just another case of that, of converting it towards a water-oriented or water technology company, and also putting a big emphasis in the global growth, because the U.S. economy wasn't looking good in the 2007-2008 time period. We took a pretty big hit here with the downturn in housing, but we were able to get through that fairly well. The shareholders have benefited from the way we were able to manage our way through that. But I'm very proud of where the company is today, and I think after 140 years of being in business, I think our future is very bright. It's going to be fun. Continue to be a small part of it, but mostly to watch and cheer on the great team that we have and what I think they're going to be able to do.
Is it likely to be a water-related business for the indefinite future?
Likely, but not guaranteed. We could find another business to get into. There's a lot of discussion about maybe getting into air purification. That looks interesting to us, especially if you've been reading the news and some of the air pollution problems in China. We already have a brand name established in China. We're one of the top 10 recognized brands in China, even though in the U.S., 97% of the people don't know what brand their water heater is. But in China, they do. It's a very different business model. But we could use that brand and branch off into some other things there.
As we have this conversation, I'm committing myself to going to the basement and checking out the brand name on my water heater.
Well, you might be like some of my friends that don't want to tell me. And then they'll tell me. I say, hey, tell you this, it's a Whirlpool. And I say, we make those. They'll say, it's a State, or it's an American, it's a Kenmore. We make all those. So it doesn't have to say A. O. Smith on it to be ours.
Do you think of yourself as a water technology company or a water manufacturer?
We're a water appliance manufacturer. We make appliances and products that get used in the water industry, water heaters in the U.S., Europe, China, and India. We're making water treatment products in China. It's now become a big part of the business, and we're expanding our plant in India. We're going to bring water treatment there. There's a huge need for water treatment devices in China and India, much bigger than the U.S. Plus, there's a lot of well-established companies in the U.S. doing it. That doesn't mean we won't have water treatment in the U.S. someday. But for right now, we're still working on the innovation. The reverse osmosis products tend to waste a lot of water. Our technologists have come up with a way of cutting that water waste by more than half. So that's an interesting product that we may bring to the U.S. someday.
Well, and the reason I ask is that you are a co-founder of the Water Council here, and we think of the Water Council as about water technology, water policy, but there's another component, and that is things like water appliance manufacturing as well.
Well, yeah, it's economic development. One of the three priorities of the Water Council is economic development. We want to see a lot of water-related businesses. We have four entrepreneurs that work in that building every day in the Global Water Center. We want to see those people need a building, need more space, and start hiring people. And a lot of companies here are keeping our eye on it. I'm very glad that we have people in that building practically every day, interfacing with these people and interacting with them. And I think, as I've told our board, if we don't end up acquiring or licensing some of those over the next 10 years, I'll be disappointed and surprised, because I think we will.
As this is going, and I know one of the things that you've talked about is that there is no finish line for the Water Council's work. There are some critics and just some observers in the community who look at the overall employment picture in the Milwaukee area, and they wonder whether the work being done on the water industry will ever play a major role in solving the region's employment challenges. Do you see it as a player in bringing down the bigger picture of unemployment in both skilled and lower skilled kinds of work?
Well, I think it's going to be all different skill levels, but we sometimes struggle getting machinists and the like, welders and the like, and a lot of the products we're going to make. But I've talked to some of those people. A lot of them have come around. I was talking with someone that was part of the State Department of Commerce, and he joked that, when you guys started this water cluster in Milwaukee and thought you could make something, he said, quite frankly, we're sitting in Madison laughing at you. We're not laughing anymore. You know, if you look at our region, if you look at the tri-state region around Chicago, over the last 10 years, we've been a full point behind the rest of the country on GDP growth. A full point of GDP growth would have been 600,000 jobs that we have not gotten in this area for any number of reasons. I mean, you could list them all. Availability of workforce, tax policies, economic development policy, everything under the sun. We'd like to see make a dent in that, and we think that the Water Council will be able to do that.
One of the things that has been a constant as A. O. Smith has reinvented itself is the activity of its engineering division. Mm-hmm. Can you speak to the role that engineering is playing in what you've done through the years?
Engineering innovation has been a hallmark of A. O. Smith for 140 years. Our original founder, C.J. Smith, was an engineer and a machinist. We have done things over the years in the early 1900s. We developed an automated machine that could make 10,000 automobile frames a day. That was unheard of. It's a big monster with hydraulics. It's still sitting in the old plant over on 35th and Capitol. But we have always had innovation. Our tagline is innovation has a name. And it's frankly rescued the company many times over those years. Not many industrial companies are still around after 140 years. It's a very small number. And the ability to reinvent ourselves, usually because of something that came out of our engineering group, has always been something of great importance.
Well, and you got into the business with an engineering degree yourself.
Yes, I have I'm a mechanical engineer. I wouldn't put myself in the category of some of the people we have in our engineering group. They're real good engineers. I was not that good an engineer. I got a degree, but I admire what they do, and it's fun to hang out with them, see what they're working on.
There's a lot of talk about science, technology, engineering, and math education, the STEM fields in this country. Do you see the colleges and universities of this country graduating enough engineers?
No, absolutely not. We struggle to get engineers, good top-notch engineers. Our largest engineering center is in Nanjing, China. We have 250 engineers there working on innovation, innovative products. And I would not limit it to just colleges and universities. We need more emphasis on STEM out of the tech schools, too. We struggle to get qualified people. So let's keep the tech schools in there, too. They need to be oriented towards science, technology, engineering, and math. Maybe it's not a four-year degree, but get people to come out that can get good jobs, good-paying jobs, and have good careers.
What gets us there?
Policy. Part of it. I think just demand is starting to drive some of it. When I moved here 10 years ago, I was on the board of a technical college, before I moved up here. And they were doing a lot more on math, technology, engineering math, training people that could be machinists than was being done here. But I've seen very much of a positive stream here with MATC and others and what they've been doing to try to fill what was a void. It's not as much of a void now.
Can you reflect on your own trip up the corporate ladder? You were a small-town product who, when you were first going to college, I wouldn't imagine necessarily thought that someday you would have had three CEO jobs by the time you were all was said and done.
No way. I didn't even know what a CEO was. I grew up in a small town. You know, I was a small-town farm kid from southern Illinois. But I went to work for GE, got exposed to some people in management. As time went on, I got exposed to people in upper management, just kept learning from everybody that I worked with, and I ended up being a president of a company that GE owned back in the 80s, and from 84 to 86, and that was transformational. I found I could do it, and I enjoyed it, and the business was successful, so that's why when an opportunity came to go be a CEO outside GE, I jumped at it, and I've had three CEO positions, and I'm not going to do it anymore. Time for somebody else to have fun.
You worked for the well-known, some might refer to him as notorious, Jack Welch at GE. What do you think you learned from him, and how do you compare your leadership style to his?
Well, Jack Welch is obviously very controversial, which he loses no sleep over. I'm a big fan of Jack's. I think creating, 2,000% growth in shareholder returns or something like that. But the things I learned from Jack more than anything else, and I got to know him very well for his first 8 years as CEO, I was still with GE, and he was my boss's boss for most of that time. So I got to go in and do capital request presentations and quarterly operating reviews and all those things with him over the years. He was always, always, always focused on the people. He told me one time that he got a lot more credit than he deserved for GE's success. And he said, the only thing I can really have an influence on is what people go into what jobs and where we spend our capital dollars, where we invest. And that's always stuck with me because Jack spends 6 weeks of every year, he did when he was chairman, 6 weeks of every year in manpower reviews. All he's doing is sitting down with the leaders, talking about people in their business. And I sat in those meetings with him, and I'd say I've got a high potential, a code one, in the phrase. What's he doing? I said, well, he's a foreman in the frame shop in Building 8 in Leary. And he said, okay. He said, have you met him? Yes, I've met him. Have you been to dinner with him? Yes, I've been to dinner with him. Have you had he and his wife over to your house? I said, no, I haven't. He said, do that. mentor that young man. That was his approach. And I've always had an opinion that it's always all about the people. That's a phrase that if we went out to our office and I walked up somebody and made a comment, it's always all about the people. They'll roll their eyes because they're sick and tired of hearing it. But it really is. And Jack put a big, big emphasis on having the right people in the right jobs, GE, and then let them do their job.
You are not necessarily seen as controversial as Jack Welch, though.
Well, my language is a little cleaner. He's a fireball. You know, I think you can get it done without so much yelling and screaming and getting in people's face. But I had a good relationship with him. I had a couple of arguments with him. The thing I admire is he'd let you say your piece. He would disagree with you, but he'd listen. And a couple of times I had an influence on what he started out with an opinion. It changed a little bit. The worst thing you can do with Jack is back down and just back away. He loves it when you come back at him. So I enjoyed working for him.
And
fun.
In the end, though, it was a decision that he was trying to make about your career that led you to leave GE.
Yeah, he was wanting me to move one more time, and I felt like I'd moved enough. I moved 9 times in 19 years with GE, and I had 2 daughters. My oldest daughter was in 6 different school districts, so I wanted to go someplace where they could finish high school and go on to college. And GE tried to move me one too many times, and I made a decision to go ahead and leave.
You've been in Milwaukee for 10 years. What do you see the trajectory of Milwaukee looking like today? Where are we headed?
Well, we need economic development. Obviously, we've missed out on a lot of jobs. One of the strengths we have is our manufacturing base here. We're really the largest concentration of manufacturing jobs in Milwaukee as anywhere in the country. There's a little town out in Silicon Valley that claims more manufacturing jobs, but they make things you can't see, so I don't count them. I think we're there. You know, we make mining equipment and all sorts of big things that you can see with Johnson Controls and Rockwell Automation and Badger Meter and all those things. So I see us having the potential to really get going with growth and economic development. It's something we need badly. Frankly, we've got to fix the education system, which is not fixed yet, and I'm not sure will be, but it has to be at some point.
I think people, when they think of the history of Milwaukee, they might have these sort of grainy newsreel images in their mind of thousands of people clocking in at the factory. Do you think Milwaukee down the road, does it still have room to grow manufacturing-wise?
Absolutely. It's got room to grow. I think a lot of companies are investing in this area. I mentioned Rexnord, for example. They're doing a lot of innovative things. It wouldn't be a surprise to me to see some investment there. The mining industry is in a little bit of a downturn now. Caterpillar's made a commitment when they acquired Bucyrus to keep running the operation here. I hope that continues. But a lot of companies, Rockwell Automation is doing some neat things, SC Johnson, I could go on and on, Badger Meter. I think that we've got a tremendous opportunity here. I think we've lost a generation of students that is very troubling with the graduation rate out of MPS, for example, and a few others that tends to be a problem. But we have a lot of really smart, dedicated people working on that problem, and I'm hopeful that they'll be able to solve it.
Well, I think our time is short, but I thank you again so much.
Sure thing, Mitch. I've enjoyed it. Thank you.
Paul Jones will retire as executive chairman of A.O. Smith Corporation in April. He'll be succeeded by Ajita Rajendra, the current president and CEO. Jones spoke with Lake Effect's Mitch Tyke in a conversation recorded on the 6th floor of the University Club of Milwaukee. Some of you have already filed your 2013 tax returns. But for the rest of us, we have some filing advice coming up next on Lake Effect. You're listening to us on WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. It's Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. We're about 6 weeks from the deadline to file our state and federal income tax returns. Some people don't mind the process, but it's safe to say that it's not something most people look forward to. But as you figure out whether you'll be getting a check or writing a check this year, our financial literacy contributor says all of us should be using this process to get ready for next year. Janet Marie Tierney tells Lake Effect's Mitch Tyke why we should already be thinking of the tax returns we'll fill out in 2015.
Well, there's a real possibility that as you're doing your 2013 state and federal taxes, you're discovering that you're either getting a refund, which can be a nice bump this time of year, or that you owe money. And how you calculate and declare your withholding can minimize your return, which means more money in your pocket today, or it can minimize the amount that you owe, which if you're trying to figure out exactly how you're going to pay the government, can also be a very good thing and keep more money in your pocket today.
Well, before we get to the nuts and bolts of that, let's take a step back, because I think a lot of people probably envision the idea of getting a big check back from the state or the federal government as a good thing. But you might contend that really that's not the point.
Well, I think what a lot of people are trying to create is a mechanism where throughout the year they're saving and they don't have the ability to take those funds out. And even over a 12-month period or even a shorter 9-month period, that can be achieved by setting up different saving arrangements with your bank. And if you do that, if you're putting that money into the bank, it's going to earn interest. Now, yes, you do have to exert some discipline, because you can stop putting money into that savings account, or you can pay the penalty and take money out of that savings account. But the bottom line is, I always tell people, if you make the commitment to yourself, you're likely to honor it. Make that commitment to say, okay, I'm going to put the money in the bank for this time period. Come next April, I'm going to pull it out and we are going to use it to take advantage of the tax time sales, to take a vacation, whatever your goal is. If you're using your withholding to save money, you really need to take into consideration that that money is not earning interest. You're providing an interest-free loan to the state or federal government, or possibly both. Especially if you are putting some of your expenses on a credit card, that means that you're borrowing money at an interest rate, in some cases a very high interest rate, while you're lending money with no interest that you're receiving. So it's just a matter of good cash management. Make sure there's more money in your pocket today so that you can save it in a bank and earn interest.
Well, so let's talk about withholding. This is a single number you put on a document called the W-4, and people might not really know the significance of what that number represents. So let's start with the very basics. How do you know how to fill out the withholding blank on the W-4?
Well, if you flip over the form, and if it's not a double-sided form, you'll typically, your employer will give it to you with two pages, and one will be the instructions, the other will be the actual form itself that you give back to your HR department. It'll walk you through what is typically considered a deduction. It asks you a series of questions. Are you considered the head of household? Are you kind of the primary wage earner for your household? Now, a lot of single people say, well, obviously, so I only have one deduction that I – one withholding allowance, they're actually called, that I can declare for myself. That's not necessarily true. You are also the head of your household, even if it's a household of one, which means you have two withholding allowances that you can declare. Withholding allowances can also exist for a spouse, for a sibling that you support, for children who you declare as dependents. But you might find as you're calculating through that you should also be declaring one withholding allowance for your mortgage interest, or auto loan interest, or student loan interest. So it's really critical to go through and even take a step beyond simply what that form is asking you and do some research on your own. And if it's difficult, talk to an accountant. That interest will probably exceed the price that an accountant will charge to answer a simple question like that.
Well, we're having this conversation and it's March, and the year has already been going on for a while now. People are listening to this. Can they adjust their withholding midstream?
You sure can. Obviously, the later in the year that you adjust your withholding, the less of an impact it's going to have for the year. So even though 3 months have gone by, or two, you still want to make sure that you're adjusting that as accurately as you can. My goal always on whether I'm getting a refund or I owe is to be within $500. $500, if I get that money, certainly I can come up with a variety of ways to spend it. But if I owe that money, the amount of time that I need to work that into my budget and repay it is relatively short, and it's short-term pain. I can get over it. I won't go without food and clothing for the rest of the year for that dollar amount. Your threshold may be different. Perhaps your household budget can tolerate $1,000, so you give yourself a little more play. When I was younger, my household budget could barely tolerate $50, so I was on top of this like you wouldn't believe.
So other than recalculating, what are some reasons for adjusting withholding amounts?
Well, the short answer is anytime you experience a life event that will result in either more taxes being owed or less taxes being owed. The list is long, but the most popular reasons are that you get a second job. So you're earning additional income. Anytime your income goes up, obviously, the amount that you're going to owe in taxes will go up. If you're doing something on the side where maybe it's a one-time payment, then you want to make sure if you're not getting a W-4 that you're making that adjustment maybe on your day job W-4 so that you're taking that into account.
So this is if you're likely to get a 1099 later in the year.
Right. The 1099 is not going to have any withholding, so you want to minimize the likelihood that you're going to owe in or completely eliminate it.
Other life events, I'm assuming things like getting married or getting divorced.
Absolutely. If you get married and you file jointly, you're eligible for a number of tax credits. On the opposite side of the spectrum, if you get divorced, you're then ineligible for those credits. So you want to make sure that you're adjusting your withholding accordingly.
We should talk a little bit about people preparing their returns because this has become an enormous business. It seems like time was there were one or two companies out there that helped people prepare their returns. But now there are companies out there that not only will help you prepare your return, but they're also offering to front you the money based on the refund that you're expecting to get.
Right. And I think two things are key here. This is a payday loan. So if you wouldn't buy your family groceries by going to a payday loan service, then don't do a refund advance loan. You're going to pay a daily interest rate. In a lot of cases, it's going to be considerably higher. If they have miscalculated the amount of your refund, you are still required to pay back the amount you borrowed. You walked out the door with the cash. So the key thing is take advantage of the systems that are in place for you to get your refund more quickly, and that's to e-file or to do your return with a direct deposit with that information filled out to receive your refund, and you'll get it more quickly.
There are actually some organizations and agencies that will assist you for no charge in doing your return.
That's right. In our area, there are several VITA sites, V-I-T-A. They will help you with your tax returns if you make $52,000 or less. And these are IRS-certified volunteers who are helping you prepare your taxes. They're also specially trained to determine if you're eligible for any special tax credits, such as the Earned Income Tax Credit, a child tax credit, or a credit for caring for the elderly or the disabled. There's also the TCE program, also uses IRS-certified volunteers. They offer free tax help to anyone, but they specialize in questions about pensions and retirement issues, so they do give priority assistance to people who are age 60 or older. Any of the VITA or TCE sites will also offer just basic self-service assistance. And if you want to take advantage of e-filing but you don't have internet access or you want a secure place to do that someplace other than the library, they'll walk you through the process so that you can file your taxes online.
Well, and I would imagine that as this is going on, they might also be useful in helping you figure out if you really are entering the right number in your withholding allowances.
They can. Now, they're volunteers, so they're going to give you a block of their time. What I would say is come in prepared so that you can ask a lot of questions about the following year. You come in with kind of what we always think of as the jumbled box of, shoebox of receipts, and they're going to spend the better part of that appointment time just getting you organized. To come in organized as you feel you're able to be, and then you have the opportunity when they say any other questions to ask them about 2014.
We also ought to make another point, and that is if you owe a lot of money on your taxes, this is really a situation where the IRS has expected you to have been paying that over the course of the year leading up to that, right?
Right. And that's where you want to reduce the amount that you're withholding. I had a coworker a number of years back who would take the maximum number of allowances on withholding. Her paycheck would be significantly higher than everyone else's because she was just shy of being having declared herself exempt from withholding. But when she did her taxes at the end of the year, I think she realized that she wasn't going to do that again. She had a significant amount that she owed. Now, the IRS will allow you to make arrangements to pay that back in an installment plan. But unlike when they keep your money and then give it to you as a refund, when you owe them money, there is interest accruing.
Well, Janet Marie Tierney, many happy returns.
Thank you.
Janet Marie Tierney is a financial educator in Milwaukee. She spoke with Mitch Teich, and you can find links to the resources that she mentioned from wuwm.com/lakeeffect. Coming up next, one of the city's top networkers expounds on the secret to her success. That's coming up when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. It's Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks for joining us. The city of Milwaukee turned 168 years old at the end of January. Its current population of around 600,000 is obviously much larger than it was when Milwaukee was incorporated in 1846. But in many ways, it's a city that is still seen by many as tightly knit. The Milwaukee Press Club seized on that concept when it threw the city's annual birthday party. The group spotlighted the 6 degrees of Milwaukee, which is not just the temperature it might be outside, but the idea that we're all connected to each other. Erica Conway is an especially connected person. She's co-owner of a company called C2 Graphics Productivity Solutions, and she told Lake Effect's Mitch Teich why she thinks she's such a good networker here.
I've spent most of my professional career here in Milwaukee trying to connect, at least in the creative community, and that's expanded to the folks I've met through the Metropolitan Association, the Metro Milwaukee Association of Commerce, as well as extending through LinkedIn, which allows me to have a broader community of folks that I talk to. I don't like to sell. I like to have people in the community who I can just call and say, hey, it's Erica, I have this opportunity, or wondering if you have a need. I prefer to call my friends and just see what's going on rather than call somebody cold. And so because of that, I've spent the last 14 years cultivating those kind of relationships so that I can either have somebody give me an intro to someone I don't know or perhaps take my call because they know of me or know me.
Do you think the climate for that has changed in Milwaukee in those 14 years that you've been doing this?
You know, I have been calling it Small Walkie for probably about the last 5 years. It seems as if once you have like a good network in Milwaukee, it grows exponentially because people are friendly enough to be willing to make introductions. And I think LinkedIn and several of the organizations here in town have really made an effort to collaborate. So there are online communities and people are collaborating amongst them. There are Meetup, which didn't exist several years ago, which also allow people to connect around topics of interest. And then there are the professional organizations who, even early in my career, I made an effort to help those organizations connect into one big setting. So we used to do this MIMA Mix It Up, which is Milwaukee Interactive Marketing Association, and we would pull together the Business Marketing Association, AIGA, which is the American Institute of Graphic Arts, ad workers, and several other groups that kind of serve the creative community and bring them together for networking and collaboration. So that has grown quite a bit now that there's the Creative Alliance Milwaukee, of which I'm a board member, and that group has really tried to connect the for-profit advertising agencies, marketing firms, for-profit creatives, as well as the performing arts, fine art, and individual artists around the city and around the region, really. So that's been really exciting because it also is an economic development component to it, which is kind of saying, like, come to Milwaukee or stay in Milwaukee. There's a really rich cultural life, and I've been thrilled to be a part of that because it does involve education and the fine and performing arts, which before the Cultural Alliance, which became the Creative Alliance Milwaukee, that really exposed me to lots of different organizations and lots of different individuals outside of the creative community.
You mentioned the reputation, the term that people use, the idea of small walkie. And there are some people who might think of that as in negative terms that, you know, that makes us feel provincial. But you would argue that small walkie is a good thing.
Milwaukee offers all of the culture of a major metropolitan city with a high degree of relationship. When you talk about the 6 degrees of Milwaukee, it's true that you really can talk to somebody and find out that their brother's cousin is somebody who works with someone you know. That happens all the time when I'm talking to people. I'm amazed at how small and connected the community is. We can get anywhere within 15 minutes in the metro area. That's brilliant. So I would take Milwaukee over Chicago any day because it's high relationship, easy to navigate, has all the resources we need. I don't think small walkie is a complaint at all. I think you get much more community and resources and friendliness in this town versus going to a larger place where making connections may be far more difficult just based on either geography or the kind of nature of people's attitudes.
You were the co-owner of something called C2 Graphics Productivity Solutions, also just known as C2. What do you do? What does your business do, and how do you feel like it connects to the Milwaukee around you?
C2 is a training and staffing firm for creatives. So our target market is working creatives who either need to get software training — we're the only Adobe-authorized training center in the state — who want to upgrade their skills either to move on to a new job or so they can do their job more efficiently. And then we're also a staffing firm, and so we represent working graphic designers, creatives, production artists, copywriters, art directors, and help them either do temporary work to supplement their freelance, or we help them get full-time jobs or long-term jobs. So I have, like I mentioned before, I don't like to sell. I like to just connect. And so I've been working with all the professional organizations. I've been on the board of AIGA and MEMA and BMA over the course of my years. I think it makes sense for C2 to be there. We sponsor a lot of things. We sit on boards. We are members. And really, we do that not so altruistically, because we really want to make connections with people who we either serve as clients or that we recruit as talent. And again, it makes it a little easier to make a case for why they might want to take part in our services if we've already been taking part in their community in a meaningful way.
Well, Erica Conway, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Erica Conway is co-owner of C2 Graphics Productivity Solutions. She was one of six people who were recognized in January for being the most connected people in the city. She first spoke with Mitch Tyke then. We'll take one last break, and then we'll turn back time to the late 70s in Milwaukee to learn about the vibrant punk scene that was here. We'll talk with local musician and author Steve Nodine next when Lake Effect returns on WUWM. We're back with more of Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio, and I'm Bonnie North. If you were in your teens or early 20s in Milwaukee from, say, the late 70s to the early 80s, you might have heard this band, the Emmodots. The singer's voice was described at the time as sounding like a witch in need of a throat lozenge, which could have also described the music a lot of punk and post-punk bands were making. If the Emmodots weren't your thing, well, perhaps it was the Oil Tasters, or Sacred Order, or In a Hot Coma. As Steve Nodine points out, you had quite a few choices in Milwaukee at the time. Nodine himself was part of the punk and post-punk scene here, mostly in his band Dark Facade, but more recently he's become the scene's historian, compiling the stories in The Cease Is Increase, an oral history of Milwaukee's punk and alternative music scene. Nodine tells us that even though Milwaukee was known at the time for its blues and its rock bands, the punk scene here was just as strong.
There was a base of clubs that supported the music and were a place that people could come to. And I think punk was a lot of misfits, people who didn't fit in school or weren't listening to what everybody else was listening to. And they went to Zach's and they discovered themselves. They could do whatever they wanted. They could wear their hair as crazy as they wanted to, and nobody cared. And, you know, you were cool. And
well, how did it differ from rock and roll in general? Because this is what, the early 70s you're talking about, more or less?
In Milwaukee, I think this club scene came together in the late 70s,
okay,
right up till 1980 when it peaked. You know, we had support of WMSC that came out in 1980, where they would play tons of local music. If you were playing that night, you could go down and say, hey, can we come on the radio? We got a show tonight. And sure, come on in, you know, and you just had that support, some support from like the Journal, the Shepherd Express. So you had the media and these clubs, and it just formed this niche of people that got together to share all this new music.
Were some of those people coming from other genres of music, you know, like the blues bands and that sort of thing that were really popular?
Yeah, and that's why the book starts out with the scene from the late 60s, early 70s, where there's like the coffee houses and all that kind of stuff. And then some of those people that were going to that were young and ended up being part of the the punk generation, people like Presley Haskell, who was in the Haskells, of course, who was instrumental in getting punk bands into Zax. And he was friends with all different people, you know, giving him ideas. And, you know, he had his mentors of people who were already in a blues band or, you know, whatever.
Rock and roll band
or something.
Rock and roll band
or something. And
one of the things that I think is so great, I'm not from here, so I'm looking at all of these scenes from the outside, but Milwaukee is both big enough to support a lot of different kinds of bands, but also small enough where everybody pretty much knows each other.
That's true.
The influencers are kind of, they overlap in an interesting way. And in reading your book, I could see that as you were interviewing all the different folks who are still around.
Right. What happened in the 80s was that there were all these mini genres. Everything kind of splintered off into pop, synth pop, like keyboards and drum machines and stuff like that. And bands like that would play at the same clubs where traditional punk bands like De Kreutzen or Sacred Order would play. And you had your power pop bands. That was really big. The Shivers, Color Radio. And we all played in the same places, and all the musicians were friends. And we had a cross of people that went to see all different kinds of music. They just wanted to be part of that energy, I think.
Do you think that's particularly Milwaukee? That the scene was that porous?
From what I know of, like, the L.A. scene or, like, Chicago, there was, in Chicago particularly, you know, there's like, the Effigies and Big Black and bands like that, and they played at the Exit, and they played at this and that. And, like, the Exit was, like, if you weren't hardcore,
you weren't
you didn't
go.
Want to go there.
It was too scary.
Yeah. So it didn't intermingle that much. And maybe there was other places where these other types of bands played at other clubs. But I don't think they mingled like that there. And especially like L.A. had their hardcore punk scene. But they had other stuff going on too. But I don't think they really mixed.
And so did that make the Milwaukee punk sound particular? And can you point to bands, you know, that were all happening at the same time, say in L.A. or London or New York and Milwaukee, and say, well, that's a Milwaukee sound because everybody was sort of feeding off each other?
Yeah, and I think that's true. And I think one of the, like, culminations of that would be, like, the Violent Femmes. The Violent Femmes were a group of people who had been around for a while playing in different bands, doing different kinds of stuff. From Victor DeLorenzo, who was part of Theater X. He really liked jazz. Brian really liked jazz. Those two got together. And the singer was a young kid who wrote all these songs while he was in high school. And he got noticed by some people in town. And they were like, oh, this guy, you got to see him. You know, he opened for somebody fairly big by himself. And next thing you know, it's Violent Femmes and
there they went.
There they went.
Yeah.
You know.
Did the punk scene evolve in a similar way here as it did, say, in London or New York as a reaction to, like, AOR and sort of the bloated prog rock stuff that people think is being very self-indulgent stuff? Was it the same here?
I think so. And I think while it might not have been as organic as it was in, say, London— but a lot of people here were reading the magazines and knowing, you know, what was going on elsewhere by reading interviews with The Clash. I think pretty much everywhere people were getting sick of, you know, what was happening with radio towards the end of the 70s and the early 80s. And one of the beautiful things about the punk scene, and this was characterized by a lot of the stuff in Milwaukee, was anybody could be in a band. Four guys that have been playing guitars for weeks could get together.
All of weeks, yeah.
You know, get in their basement and start jamming. And if they were into it enough, they got accomplished enough that they could play songs. And they wrote songs. And
what were some of the notable punk bands from Milwaukee that people listening might go, oh, yeah, I went and saw them?
Well, there was Sacred Order. They were pretty big. De Kreutzen, who toured everywhere. They were just on the road constantly. They had a record contract with Touch and Go. They were getting airplay on college radio. They never made it big, but they certainly left their mark. And they're still been interest in them today. They just played a big concert in Europe somewhere.
Now, is there a Milwaukee-specific sound? Like, I'm thinking band makeup, like particular instruments. Did we focus on things that way, or was it pretty much all over the board?
Well, the punk bands were pretty typically bass, guitar, drums, lead singer.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the power pop bands had, you know, multiple guitars, keyboardists, organs, and pop.
The famous Hammond B3 sound.
Yeah, yep. Correct. Mm-hmm. So, and then there were bands like Dark Facade that, you know, had a Dave Wolf playing keyboards, who was kind of our own Keith Emerson kind of guy. He was in prog rock bands back in the 70s, and he was really good. And so you had people, you know, using different things. But as far as a Milwaukee sound, I guess if you weren't from here and you listened to a compilation of Milwaukee bands, you might go, oh, yeah, you know, they do have kind of a sound. But
it's hard from inside.
It's hard for me to say what that would be.
That leads me to the format of the book, too, which I find great because basically it is exactly what the title says it is, an oral history. You interviewed all of these people, both musicians and people who were around, you know, writing about it at the time or just experiencing it at the time. Did you always have that construct in mind when you were going to put the book together, or did it evolve itself?
Well, the way the idea for the book came about was through Facebook. I raised a daughter. I was working. I'm a web developer. Been in the corporate world for years, and all of a sudden Facebook came along, and I'm like, oh, look, it's Keith, so-and-so. And we all just started. And then this guy, Mike from Sacred Order, started this page on Facebook where it was a conversation about Lest We Forget, it was called, and they had this concert, Lest We Forget. And it was about we're getting older and a lot of us have passed away from this or that, and started this whole conversation. And it just organically grew into this. We all reconnected. So I talked to my friend Keith Bramer, who was into Kreutzen, and he had the idea of the oral history, and he pointed me to a couple books, Just Shoot Me, and we have The Neutron Bomb about the L.A. scene and about punk in general. And I read those, and while I didn't really follow their format, but I liked the idea of the oral history because it's everybody's voice. It's not just me saying, in 1982, you know, their stories. And one of the great things I see about the book now that people have told me is you can just pick it up and flip to a page and just start reading.
And there are some wonderful photos, too. Were people donating copies of pictures?
Yeah, I knew of people who took pictures back then. And I made some contacts with Jim Prince, who I was in a band in, called Between Walls. He was a bass player, and he's a photographer in Chicago. He had a whole bunch of stuff, and I didn't even know he had taken so many pictures. And he gave me just about everything he had to pick from. And Guy Hoffman from the Oil Tasters, Haskell's, gave me a bunch of photos with my permission to use.
In the course of doing the book, did you reconnect with people that you thought you'd never see again?
Oh, yes. And it also spurred a reunion show of my band Dark Facade. I think that was the same year that they did the Lest We Forget show. And that was great, getting together with everybody. Although we had to plug in some players because some people couldn't make it. Lisa, our bass player, who's in the Amidots also, lives in Berlin, Germany. And the guitarist hadn't played guitar for so long that he didn't feel comfortable being on stage. So we got Jack Jurassic, who was in a band called Kafka back in the 80s, and he played guitar for us. I mean, just seeing these people again after 20 years or more was just phenomenal.
Years fell away?
Oh, yeah. And doing the interviews, too. Some of these people that I interviewed I knew well, and some I really didn't know anything about them. But talking to them, we realized we had common ground. And
do you think there's more to explore in this scene? That does this book just kind of get the ball rolling and then there's really more to do?
I think you could probably do a part two and take it into the 90s. A lot of the people who were in bands in the 80s didn't stop making music in 1990. and some of them did pretty well. And I think it could be pursued.
I was going to say, there's your next project, because to watch the evolution of what they did after they were doing this in the late 70s and early 80s would be really interesting musically, I would think.
It would be, yeah.
So yeah. Get writing.
Yeah. I'm actually writing a fictional book right now. I'm trying my hand at that. But
when you're done.
When I'm done.
Are you playing? Did this get you back into playing?
Yeah, actually it did. After the reunion show, my friend Kirk McFarland, who was in Einstein's Rice Boys and all different bands, and I got together, and he plays guitar and drums and keyboards. He's multi-talented. And we started just sitting down and writing songs, and he had some stuff that he had together already, and we're in the studio right now recording a CD,
so
which might come out this summer.
Very cool. So it's like, you know, punk take two.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, Steve Nodine, it has been such a pleasure to talk to you and to read the book, The Cease Is Increase, An Oral History of Milwaukee's Punk and Alternative Scene. And I look forward to part two.
Well, thank you. And thank you, Bonnie, for having me here today. I enjoyed it.
Me too. Steve Nodine is the author of The Cease Is Increase, An Oral History of Milwaukee's Punk and Alternative Music Scene. We're going out with him and his band Dark Facade from an early 80s recording of their tune, Slave to Love. And I'm Bonnie North. Thanks, as always, for tuning in today. We're looking forward to having you join us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for Lake Effect from listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned. Fresh air comes your way next.